chapter 13, 1 through 13. Although I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not charity, I am become as sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and of all knowledge, and though I have all faith, so that I could remove mountains and have not charity, I am nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and so I give my body to be burned and have not charity, it profits me nothing. Charity suffereth long and is kind. Charity envieth not. Charity vaunteth not itself, is not puffed up, doth not behave, nor itself unseemingly, seeketh not her own, is not easily provoked, thinketh no evil, rejoiceth not in iniquity, but rejoiceth in the truth, beareth all things, believeth all things, hopeth all things, endureth all things. Charity never faileth, but whether there be prophecies, they shall be failed. Whether there be tongues, they shall cease. Whether there be knowing, knowledge, it shall vanish away. For we know in part, and we have prophecy in part, but what that which is perfect to come, then which that which is in part shall be done away. When I was a child, I spoke as a child. I understood as a child. I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away my childish things. For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then shall I know, even as also am known. And now abideth faith, hope, charity, these three. But the greatest of these is charity.
Morning. This morning we'll bring to conclusion a series we have been working through. It's a short series dealing with 1 Corinthians chapter 12 and leading into chapter 13. It's been dealing primarily with the abilities, or Paul sometimes calls them gifts, or sometimes he calls them activities, or 100 other synonyms he uses to describe what it is that you can do in offering God's service, and how each person has something to offer. By way of review, let me just kind of summarize what we've talked about in the last couple of lessons from chapter 12. First of all, we notice that God gives to each individually, by which we mean that every believer has God-given gifts, activities, or services that they are able to use in God's service. Furthermore, we notice that God is the one who empowers. That is, God is the giver of gifts, and he distributes them as he chooses. So what you're able to do isn't necessarily something you picked. It is the shape that God has given you. You get some free will in it, but there's also some of it that's not. Some of it is your upbringing or influences beyond your control. But ultimately, God gets the glory for what we're able to do, and what we ought to do is to glorify him. Number three, we notice that there are varieties. Not all gifts are the same. Not all gifts are given the same way. And no two people are shaped the same way. Every individual is different, and that's good news, because it turns out the body, the church, has lots of different work to do. If we only had one tool at our disposal, we could do exactly one job. But instead, because the church has so much work to do and so many different circumstances where it needs to be done, we need all the different tools that God has given us, and that variety is helpful. So because of that, we know that we should work for the common good. Every gift is given for the service of others to God's glory. And we emphasize that, again, against the narrative we're given in our secular culture, where what you're able to do is what you have by, I don't know, chance or genetics or evolution or whatever it is that you got it by, and you use it for your own benefit, for your own good, make some money and be happy. That's what life's about. Paul says, what you have from God. What you have, you use for others. And that's the important part from chapter 12. Well, that's all good stuff. But then chapter 12 ends with this rather cryptic statement beginning in verse 28. And God has appointed in the church first apostles, second prophets, third teachers, then miracles, then gifts of healing, helping, administrating in various kinds of tongues? Are all apostles? Are all prophets? Are all teachers? Do all work miracles? Do all possess gifts of healing? Do all speak with tongues? Do all interpret? But earnestly desire the higher gifts. And I will show you a still more excellent way. So he ends with a great summary of kind of what we've been talking about. There's great variety. God has given a variety of gifts to the Corinthian church. Lots of things they're able to do. He says you should be looking for and developing these abilities to the service of all. But there's something even more important. That's that last line, that cryptic line. That's a great transition line to another sermon, right? He says, I've got something else that you've got to learn, more important even than the distinctions he's been making so far. And that's the lesson of love that comes from chapter 13. It's interesting what we've done with chapter 13, and I'm as guilty as anybody. 1 Corinthians 13 has become a wedding ceremony chapter. That it's, we believe fully in romanticism when it comes to weddings. We want there to be love there. But we have not been terrifically good about applying it where Paul actually applies it, which is to the life of the church and to the body. That's where this love is supposed to be applied, and we need to take a look at that. Look first of all at his points he's going to make in verses 1 through 3 about love and how it relates to the abilities and gifts that an individual has. If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels but have not love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. In the ancient world, the old pagan religions, well, they were noisy religions. You know, the pagan gods, they went to sleep sometimes. The old prophets used to make fun of them for that. The pagan gods went to sleep sometime. You had to wake them up. And so in the old pagan worship, there was lots of noise making. So you'd shake bells and you'd beat things and so forth. And in Corinth, I'm sure there was a great deal of that come worship time for the pagans. And maybe Paul is kind of hinting that direction. That this is, it's offensive. It really is. It's not beautiful music. It's not a symphony. It's not God's love being played out in melody. It's just offensive noise. As every musician or band director knows, in a band room, not everybody thinks they can play a trumpet, but for some reason, everybody thinks they can play percussion. I don't know why that is. It's the universal truth. You look at it and you think, oh, I could play a drum. And so at the end of a band rehearsal, the drummers put down their drums, and slowly the other people wander back there, and they all want to kind of tinker with this and play with that, because everybody thinks they can be a percussionist. Is there a more offensive sound, Matt, than people who don't know what they're doing? Yeah, it's terrible, right? They're just kind of making noise on the instruments. It's not music. It's offensive. It's just noise. And that's what Paul says you are when you have even tremendous ability, but not the love that goes with it. Without love, we offend others. Maybe you can do tremendous things, maybe you can make a lot of noise, but you're just offensive, and you're not helpful to the cause of God. Verse 2, he goes on, and if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains but have not love, I am nothing. That's a big statement. The Bible says a lot about the value of the human person. So when Paul makes this slightly exaggerated statement, you should take notice that he's doing it. It's a big statement. No matter the drama you bring with your phenomenal cosmic powers and your miraculous gifts and your understanding of all mysteries, and that's one that I find interesting. Because a lot of people think they have to be the best person in church because they understand the most. Usually those are the people who understand the least, but they don't know it. That's okay. They think they know all things, and so they are the most substantive and important part of the church. They understand all mysteries. They have all faith. They know what you should be doing. Maybe you're one of those. Paul says, if I knew it all, and he doesn't claim to, but if I knew it all, he said, I would still be nothing. He doesn't say, I wouldn't be the most important person in the church. He says, not even I would be the least important person in the church. So I would be nothing. There is no value, no matter the power you assess yourself to have, or the knowledge you assess yourself to have, there is no value to a life lived without any love at all. It's hard to imagine. It would be the most inhuman a person could be. Humans are wonderful and valuable because they're made in the image of God. If they don't have love, in what sense are they in God's image anymore? Right? Because God is love. And so you would be, in essence, emptying yourself of all your humanity. if you don't have love, regardless of your abilities and gift. Verse 3, if I give away all I have, and if I deliver up my body to be burned, but have not love, I gain nothing. What if I do incredible acts, right? If I give away literally everything that I possess to people who are in need, that has to make me great, doesn't it? Doesn't that get me something? Isn't this kind of a bargain where we say, God, here is how much I'm willing to give. What do you give back? What if I was willing to die? Now that's got to be the tops, right? If a person, not just die, to die cruelly, if I could be burned for the gospel, wouldn't that mean that I've given the most I could possibly give and God owes me something? Paul says, I gain nothing. This isn't a bargaining arrangement where you say, I did this, now you owe me this. God is looking for something totally different in us. He's looking for what he's given us, which is love, first and foremost. And so he says in these three statements, without love, I offend, I am offensive. Without love, I am nothing. Without love, I gain nothing. Then in verses 4 through 7, he talks about the positive qualities of love and why that's so essential. Look at the way it's described in this passage. I think it's really magnificent. Beginning in verse 4, love is patient and kind. First of all, love overcomes, but it does so with goodness. Love is this mysterious power. It really is. What is power? Power is the ability to influence, to exert influence on other people, to get what you want. If a politician is very powerful, doesn't that mean that he can get his way? If a military is powerful, that means they're strong enough to get what they want. That's what we think of with power. The scriptures tell us that love is more powerful still than that, but it's powerful differently. It's powerful not through force of arms, not through coercion, not through manipulation. And a lot of people do confuse manipulation with love. Love is powerful because of its incredible goodness. It overcomes, it says, with patience and kindness. Isn't that exactly the opposite of what we've been trained power to think power is in the world? Who's a powerful person? It's a person who acts with urgency and intolerance, who gets his way. That's power. He knows what he wants, he goes and gets it, he stomps on whoever he has to. That's a powerful person. Love is the opposite. Love takes as long as it needs, and it's nice about it. Love is patient, love is kind. It overcomes, and it's powerful, but it's a different kind of power. It's a power of goodness. Love overcomes darkness. The great German theologian Karl Barth said in this passage that there's three darknesses in this passage that love is said to overcome, and I like his discussion of it. First of all, love overcomes the darkness in ourselves. Love does not envy or boast. It is not arrogant or rude. The worst things about us are all the things he just mentioned. Certainly, the problem he's having in Corinth is this debating over who's the most important person in the church, who has the best abilities and gifts, who's the one that God really loves. Paul says, love overcomes that in yourself. Love is the capacity, yea, the necessity, to value other people and put them above yourself. If you put others above yourself, you just can't be these things. You can't envy or boast because you value other people more. You can't be arrogant or rude because you value other people more. Love conquers the darkness that is inside of each one of us, the sin that resides in our heart. Love is triumphant over it. Love overcomes the darkness that exists in our relationship to others. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. Back growing up in the Seminole Church of Christ, we had a preacher at one point named Phil Davis, really nice guy, learned the hard way never to ask my dad a question in a Bible class. And he asked the adult class, what is love? And Dad looked up, I guess without taking a breath, and said, love is how I put up with you. And it wasn't exactly the answer that Phil was looking for. Dad's sense of humor is dry, is not even the word. But his point was absolutely spot on, right? How does any human being put up with any human being, any other human being? How do we do it? anyone, I don't care if it's the one you pick to marry, your own children, your parents, the person sitting next to you right now, don't look, they're looking at you. How do any of us get along with anybody else? Love, the ability, the necessity of putting other people first is the only way we can do it. Because as long as you put yourself first, if everybody in the room puts themselves first, then everybody thinks they're first, and no one can possibly get along with anybody else. But when everybody is looking to the needs and cares and concerns of others, well, then we can do these things. It does not insist on its own way. If I actually value you, I don't have to get my way. We have a fake version of love. What we often mean by love is, I love you so long as you agree with me. Because then I still get my own way. And so I can call it love and we can get along because you and I agree. But when you and I stop agreeing, well, I don't know, we can have this love anymore. Paul says, that's not love. Love actually values the other person, values them so much that you can disagree, they can get their way, and you can still love them because you care for who they are as a person. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. Well, that was unpleasant, Paul. He didn't have to go there, did he? He's gone to meddling now. Love actually behaves in a certain way, the way he called kindness and patience earlier on. And that's just terribly unfair. Wouldn't it be nicer, wouldn't it be better for us all if Paul said, you do the right thing and you can be as mean, as ugly and unpleasant as you have to be to get it done. And a lot of us live exactly that way. Paul says, love is not resentful. Love is not irritable. Love is looking out for other people and overcomes the darkness that is in each one of us. And it does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. Love doesn't have to get its own way. But love does insist on God's way. Love does know that God is best for this world. And it doesn't go along with something just because it would make someone happy. Love and happiness are not necessarily the same thing. Love is actually looking for what's best. You love your children, so you take them to the doctor. And the doctor's going to give them a shot. And know what your child says? If you loved me, you wouldn't make me get the shot. You wouldn't make me ever feel pain. And you do it anyway. Why? Because you love them. You don't rejoice in the disease they would get if they didn't get the shot. You want them to be healthy and whole, and you know that might hurt. Love does not rejoice in wrongdoing. It rejoices in truth. Finally, love overcomes the apparent darkness in God. Now, what does that mean? And notice the word apparent. There is no actual darkness in God. John says in 1 John chapter 1, God is light, and in him is no darkness at all. But when we look at God and what God's doing in the world, sometimes it looks pretty dark and mysterious. When we look at God and we say, this is the world he made and people are suffering. Evildoers sometimes seem to come out on top. Wrong goes unpunished. We believe that God is good, but when we look around at this world, it's not always easy to see that, is it? Love even allows us to overcome that mystery. And to value our God. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. When these Christians in Corinth were suffering at the hand of persecutors, they endured all things. They didn't say, well, if God loved me, this wouldn't happen. They said, God loves me still. And love was able to conquer even in that moment. Love is the capacity to overcome the darkness wherever it is found. Love never ends. Now, the great mystery of this passage for a lot of commentators and preachers, self-included, is verses 8 through 10. I'm going to do my best in a short amount of time to address what's going on here. Love never ends. As for prophecies, they will pass away. As for tongues, they will cease. As for knowledge, it will pass away. For we know in part and we prophesy in part, but when the perfect comes, the partial will pass away. If you look in commentaries, you'll get as many interpretations of this as you'll get commentaries. And if you ask Ben Williams, up until this moment, you will probably get this answer. Here's what I think, but I'm pretty sure I'm wrong about that. I've actually said that in this pulpit because I have an interpretation of this passage, but I've always struggled with it because my interpretation isn't anything that Paul's talking about. And so I really fought with that this week, and I said, can I do better? Is there a way to read this that is truer to what Paul is trying to say? I'm going to give you what I arrived at, and it may not be helpful to you. But I think in the keeping with the text, this is the best answer I can give to what Paul is getting at. This statement, when that which is perfect is come, the partial is done away with, is a proverb. He's not stating something that he has a particular application in mind. I think the reason I have always found this passage so vague is because Paul is being intentionally vague. He could have said it literally any other way, but instead he insisted on saying it like that. When that which is perfect is come, then that which is partial be done away with. It even sounds like a proverb. Answer a fool according to his folly. When the perfect has come, the part is done away, right? It's a proverbial statement. And what it's trying to tell you is this basic truth that applies to a whole lot of different circumstances, one which might apply here and one would apply to us. We use tools to get the job done, but when the job's done, the tools aren't as important as the job. When you're working in construction, you have favorite tools. Maybe you've got the finest hammer in all the land, right? It's a great hammer. But does anybody fall in love with their hammer? No, you say, it's a hammer. It does a job, and when I'm done with that job, the goal is to live in a house, not to hold a really great hammer that built a house. Ultimately, the construction, the effort, the energy, the tools contribute to the whole, but they aren't the whole. And we're not supposed to fall in love with them. This is true of the Corinthians. In this particular moment in Corinthian history, they had oodles of miraculous, revelatory gifts just coming out their ears. They speak in tongues, they have prophecy, they have all kinds of stuff going on. And Paul says, there's going to come a time when you're going to realize those were tools trying to get a job done. And when the job's done, those tools aren't what you were supposed to be in love with. They had fallen in love with the hammer. The tongues existed for a purpose, to bring about some good, but it wasn't the good itself, and the time would come when that needed to stop. That's also true of your life. Every person has seasons where your gifts and abilities and talents are very obvious and you can do things with them, and times when it's not so clear. I asked Randy Brown if I could use him as an example, and he begrudgingly said yes. Randy Brown is one of my favorite all-time song leaders. No offense to the rest of you song leaders. You're all fine. He's my favorite. Okay, Randy Brown, fantastic song leader. However, in the last year or so, he has struggled a little bit with his throat and with his voice, and he doesn't feel comfortable now getting up and leading singing the way that he did very often. He will from time to time if we cajole him correctly and manipulate him in the way that we do. But more often than not, he says no because he's just not confident in his voice because of changes in his own throat. Others of you that have led singing know that experience, right? That something changes and you say, well, I'm not sure I can do that quite the way I did. Now, what if Randy only identified himself as a song leader? That's what I am. I'm the most important person in this congregation because I'm a song leader. Well, when that part, when that tool, when its season of usefulness goes away, now what is he? Well, now he's nothing. He's exactly all the things that Paul said a person is without love. He's a noisy cymbal, right? He has no gain. Because he fell in love, in this case he didn't, but in that my hypothetical, he fell in love with the tool and not what the tool was trying to accomplish. Preachers have the same issue, by the way. A preacher, an older preacher told me this some years ago, and I've tried to remember it. I'll paraphrase the best I can, and I'll use my own name to make the point. But the career of a preacher goes like this. Who is Ben Williams? Ben Williams is going to be a preacher someday. We need more young preachers like Ben Williams. We need more young preachers like Ben Williams used to be. Remember Ben Williams? Who's Ben Williams? And that's kind of the career for a lot of preachers, if you're lucky, right? That there's a season where you feel very effective and people tell you you're great. But there comes a time, if you're lucky enough to live long enough, where every preacher's effectiveness changes. He's not able to be effective in the same ways. He's able to be effective in different ways. Okay. And if you fall in love with, what I was told, if you fall in love with preaching and that's who you are, I am a preacher. That's who I am. And that's all that matters, and that makes me better than you. Then when the day comes and I can't do that the way that I do now, then what happens? I am nothing. I have no gain. I'm a sounding gong. Okay? And the same is true for every one of you. In certain times in a family's life, they can contribute more to the collection than others. You have abilities that you can assist other people in some ways, and then other times you need assistance. What Paul is saying is, the perfect is what God is doing. The part is what he allows you to contribute. Don't fall in love with the part. In the time of the Corinthians, it was these miraculous gifts. That's the point of the proverb. And there was going to be a time when they wouldn't do those. In the life of every Christian, it might be your natural abilities. There'll be seasons where you can do one thing, seasons you can other. Seasons when you can serve as a deacon or an elder, seasons where you don't. Seasons where you can teach, seasons where you can't. Season when you're a capable evangelist, seasons when you need someone to take you to church. There are going to be different times of life, and if you fall in love with the tools, you fall in love with the parts, then you're missing the point. That's not what God's doing. God isn't trying to make Corinthians who can speak in tongues. God's trying to make Christians. God's trying to make people in the image of his Son. That's the whole. And everything else simply contributes to that. Don't fall in love with the tools. Fall in love with the Son, the person he's trying to make you in. All parts end in God's whole. And when you cannot do, you can still love. When every ability you have has faded, when you believe you have nothing left to offer God or his people, love is still there. You can still be a loving person. That is a gift that no human ever actually loses. It is what you can contribute in every season of your life, and it's what allows you to find the other things you can contribute because you love. Everything else fades. Love doesn't. And so he concludes the passage with a couple of analogies. He talks about children. Children being children is beautiful. That's what children are supposed to be. Is there anything more offensive than an adult trying to be a child? Right? That's not the way it's supposed to work. Paul says things change. People grow up. That's the way it's supposed to work. Things you do now won't be the things you do later. He talks about looking in a mirror or a glass. Looking in a mirror, and Corinth was famous. They made mirrors. It was one of their exports. Looking in a mirror, well, that's great. But that's not the same as seeing a person face to face. Here's a modern analogy. Sometimes I do counseling via internet, and I can FaceTime with them and see them through a computer screen. No one who does that thinks it's the same as being there in person. It's just not the same. And that's the point he's making. He says, things are moving into God's whole. This perfect reality that God is trying to create in you. Forget the parts. Learn what God is doing, the thing that we're maturing into, what he's trying to accomplish, a perfect scripture, a mature word, a mature church, a mature person, a mature world. God is growing something. He is producing something. And that's what we contribute to. God's plan at work now in immaturity and mystery will end in the perfection of love. And so he says in verse 13, so now faith, hope, and love abide, these three. But the greatest of these is love. The tool that you absolutely have to have is love. In life, you'll have other characteristics that come and go, things you can give and things that you'll lose. But ultimately, love is what allows you to see what you can do and what you are and use it to contribute to the cause of God, his perfect whole that he's working in each one of us and all of us collectively. Look at yourself and ask yourself, not what can I do for myself? That's not love. Ask, what can I do to serve others? What can I do for the glory of God? Find what you can do. Don't fall in love with it, but find it and start doing it. The first thing you do, though, is love. It's the love of Christ that comes in faith. The love that says, well, as Christ said, if you love me, keep my commandments. That turns to him and says, I love him and I want to do his way. That confesses him as the Savior and is baptized to begin a life in his service of love that will continue and abide. If you've not begun that life of love, as we stand and sing a word of encouragement, won't you come?